Do you have the rights you think you have? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Glad to be back in the studio for our weekly foray into what's happening out there and how to take a biblical worldview of it.
Absolutely. And Chuck, this is oftentimes, you know, we talk about all the little political things that are going on, but then sometimes some issue thrusts itself up on the scene, which really, you know, kind of transcends the politics, although it is, politics are deeply involved in this particular issue, but that, you know, we need to actually stop and look at the deeper implications of these actions and these issues that are going on from that biblical perspective to help people to understand why they should be paying attention and why it's so important. And, of course, the issue that we want to talk about today is the ongoing battle over Charlie Gard. And just a little bit of a background there, I guess. For those who may not be aware, although this has probably been in the media at one level or the other for the last at least couple of weeks, Charlie Gard is a small child, a baby, who has a rare disorder. And that rare disorder is life-threatening. And Charlie Gard has parents who are loving parents and who want the best for their child, and so they've been seeking medical care, and they're English, and so they're in Britain, and they went to the British Health Service, which we know is basically run by the government, and the government has decided that Charlie is really, well, let's basically get right down to it. It's going to cost too much money to care for Charlie. And so the hospital doesn't want to continue care. So the parents have worked to try to say, you know, okay, we found a hospital in the United States that's doing research on this issue that this baby has and is willing to, you know, treat the baby. And they were getting ready to get the baby released from the hospital so that they could basically transport him, fly him over to the U.S. to get treatment for this condition. Except the hospital refuses to release the child. That's right. The hospital has decided they know more about the care and the ultimate outcome of this child's health care than the parents do. And so, therefore, they are refusing the parents to take the child somewhere where he can actually receive the care he needs. And what the hospital really is planning on doing is letting the baby die so that they can continue on in their socialized medicine way to say they know best. Now, Chuck, if people aren't aware of this issue, they need to be aware of it because there are some stunning implications of the outcome of this particular issue.
Oh, there's major. If you think about what's going on here, this is the nexus. This is where biblical morality and ethics clashes with government quote unquote morality and ethics. In England, especially, they have this National Health Service. And one of the things you'll hear about those who want to have single-party pay systems, what do we mean by that, single-party pay? That means the government pays for your health care, essentially. You pay taxes, the government turns around and turns those taxes into quote-unquote free health care for you. This is one of the outcomes that comes from that, the single-party pay system. Now, what do I mean by the nexus? Well, okay, the government decides, rather than the medical community, really. The medical community does sort of indirectly decide, but the government decides who lives and who dies. Now, how do they do that? Remember when Sarah Palin got such terrible press when she was running for vice president with the odious John McCain? that she talked about what became Obamacare. She was talking about death panels, and the press just went insane. Oh, ha, 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 what an idiot she is. She doesn't know what she's talking about. Well, in this case...
Go ahead. And this is the same media that basically said that Sarah Palin was responsible for Gabby Giffords getting shot.
Well,
right?
Some of them did, and then of course later they had to back away from that because it was utter nonsense. The guy who did the Gabby Giffords shooting was a someone who was actually an occasional attender at the same
synagogue
that she was. So, and he was. If he had any political convictions at all, he was decidedly leftist.
Right. And I just throw that out there because it's like the media wants to pile on any conservative who might actually, you know, have said something or made some kind of comment somewhere that they feel was a triggering event for somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you've got that whole thing. So go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump in.
So anyway, they're making fun of her for this idea of death panels. Well, okay, Charlie Gard, this little 11-month-old baby who's got a disease, a genetic disease, which means really right now there is no cure for this disease because it affects, there's something wrong with his DNA. Either with the DNA itself or with his gene expression. That's the beauty of it. If you can affect gene expression, a lot of times you can fix these so-called DNA diseases. But that's a segue. Right now, there isn't any cure. What does that mean? Well, Britain has looked at the situation. A hospital panel or a national healthcare, National Health Service panel has looked at it and said, this child will be a burden on the system. Therefore, rather than an asset to the system for his entire life, however long or short that may be, a lot of times the kids who have this disease, which is mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome, live between usually 2 and 12 years. They have said, well, he will be a burden to the system and will make no contributions whatsoever, and therefore we're going to stop treatment so he dies.
And think about that phrase, make no contribution. So now the government will measure whether or not an individual can make a contribution, i.e. be a good little citizen within the government framework, or not, as to whether or not they have the right to live. Now, Chuck, you know, people may gasp in horror at that and think how horrible of this, you know, of Britain and all of these socialists. But let's not kid ourselves. We do it every day of the year here in the U.S. It's called abortion.
Yeah,
we legalize it, and we say that, well, this is too much of a burden on this woman or the parents, et cetera, blah, 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 blah. And so, therefore, we say it's perfectly fine that you can eliminate this child in the womb, not just after they come out and maybe have a difficulty or as this child has a genetic disorder.
Yeah, exactly. So essentially, although let's do the difference here, who makes the decision in the case of an abortion?
Well, usually it's the woman.
Yeah, usually it's the mother.
You know, that's usually the case, is that the parent's making the decision. And in the Charlie Gard case, it's very, very interesting because, and this is where we're heading to, Chuck, let's not kid ourselves here in America. This is where we're heading to, that we have the schools that act as what we call in loco parentis, which means in place of the parent. Now in Britain, we have the medical establishment acting in place of the parent. And don't think it isn't happening here, folks. There are bills that are being passed in our Ohio legislature that basically would give doctors a say over your decision making for your own children, whether or not you want to have them vaccinated. Whether you want to seek a second opinion when they tell you that you must do something with your child's health. We're already there. It's not popped to the surface like this particular issue has, because we still hold on to this facade that we don't have socialized medicine in this country. But hey, let's not kid ourselves. We've been under the ACA now for 7 years. And it doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon, Chuck. If Mitch McConnell is, you know, the more he talks, the farther and farther away it gets from the Congress holding on to their promises of completely repealing Obamacare, which is basically the socialized medicine, similar to what Britain has right now. So as we're talking about Charlie, folks, you need to think about what you're experiencing or have thought or have heard with our own healthcare system. You know, we already have the situation where, you know, you've got families that have to fight the medical system because the medical system says that you have to do this or you can't do that, and they have to fight them in court. And oftentimes, we, you know, the courts lean still toward the individual, but I see a day coming very shortly, Chuck, where it's not going to be that way.
No, you think about it, Barry. You say we've been under Obamacare for 7 years. Well, we have been, but we've been under Medicare and Medicaid since 1965.
Yes, absolutely.
That's 52 years. It is socialized medicine.
Yes, it is.
No doubt about it. And a lot of the trouble that we had with our healthcare system, essentially that led to Obamacare, is Medicare and Medicaid. Because what did it do? It created a giant bureaucracy that had to be paid for. It essentially caused institutions like churches to get out of the hospital running game. I don't want to say business, because hospitals, yeah, they were run somewhat like a business, but the fact is that if you look at most hospitals that aren't county hospitals, they were run by a church or some other charitable organization.
Sure. Riverside
Methodist. You had Mount Carmel, which was a Catholic institution. Virtually every hospital had a charitable institution. That has changed drastically in the 52 years since Medicare and Medicaid. Why? Well, because you, in the 80s, you had the growth of the movement, the idea that, well, these churches shouldn't be getting access to federal money because it violates the separation of church and state, which, by the way, we will reiterate, does not exist in the United States Constitution.
Yeah, thank you.
That particular language or sentiment is not there. What is not allowed to be done is that Congress shall make no law establishing a national religion or interfering with the free exercise thereof, and somehow that's been turned on its head to mean the converse, that somehow giving federal payments for services to a church-run hospital would somehow be the establishment of a national religion, which is an absurdity on its face. Nonetheless, that's the... That is the scenario. Now, what do we have here? Well, we have a situation where the government, or let's just say a quasi-government agency, because the National Health Service isn't directly, would not be considered directly run by the government. It would be an appointed body. So, in other words, we have bureaucrats who are more or less independent of everything, depend on the government for their money, but independent of them, you know, if Parliament were to pass some law and it you know, went through their parliamentary procedure to become law, to say that Charlie Gard couldn't be killed, well, he could not be, you know, deprived of his treatment, but they're not going to do that, because what do governments do best? They hide behind their bureaucracies. They wring their hands and say, there's nothing really we can do. Well, is there something they can do, Barry? Is that ever the case when the government wrings its hands and says there's nothing we can do? Is that ever really the case?
No, because, well, you know, it's funny because in those cases, government's powerless, but in every other case, they're all powerful.
They're all powerful. Yeah, exactly right. It's sort of convenient finding themselves constrained constitutionally conveniently, when it's convenient for them, not when it's actually true. Because right. When they are actually constitutionally constrained from doing this or that, they violate that at will.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about that.
So what do we have in Charles Gard? Well, we have a. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say because the London newspaper, The Telegraph, has got an interesting story about this, about the hearings that are going on around this, and they've got a timeline. And I thought it would just be instructive for us to kind of maybe read down through this timeline that they've provided.
Okay.
To give you guys, give our listeners kind of a feel for what's been happening. And then we can fill in around the edges. So Charlie Gard was born on August the 4th of 2016. So the child is looking at maybe his first birthday here in a couple of weeks.
He's 11 months old.
Okay.
Yeah.
11 months old, yeah. In September of 2016, he came down ill, and the physicians diagnosed him with a rare genetic condition, which Chuck's already talked about, and he was admitted to Great Ormond Street Hospital in London. And so in January, of course, this is in September, so he's been in the hospital since September, Chuck.
Yeah.
So that's quite a bit of time, 10 months in the hospital. In January of this year, his parents, Chris Gard, and his mother is Connie Yates, a young couple. They're probably maybe in their late 20s, maybe 30s, but I doubt it. I think
young.
Maybe in the mid to late 20s. Oh, no, they actually are in their 30s, according to the article. They look a lot younger, even though they've been through such an ordeal. So basically, in January, they set up a GoFundMe page to pay for Charlie to travel to the U.S. because there are hospitals in the U.S. are doing experiments on a nucleoside therapy that addresses this particular genetic disorder. Amazing that when you have a less completely socialized healthcare system, you actually have research that goes on and development on treatments and things to combat these problems. So they're looking to come to the U.S. So this was back in January. Well, between January and the beginning of March of this year, something happened. Something broke down. The hospital, and probably their ethics panel, because almost every hospital has an ethics panel, Chuck. Now, those are your real death panels, is your hospital ethics panel. Because they're made up of a bunch of different people, not just physicians, but also social workers and others, and maybe even a couple of government employees. Your board of directors make up part of your ethics panel, and they make the determination on which direction the hospital will go. So by the 3rd of March of this year, the administration at Great Ormond Street Hospital went to court to get a ruling from a justice, Justice Francis of the London court, to rule that life support treatment should stop. They wanted to end treating the child. So you stop and think, okay, parents just raised money to take him to U.S. to get therapy. The hospital's had the child since September, and they want to end treatments. What's the problem? You know, release the child to the parents, let the parents bring him to the U.S., and let's get it going. Nope, can't do that. They go to the courts because they refuse to release the child to the parents because they've determined that the child doesn't have a life expectancy, et cetera. And basically they said that Charlie could only breathe through a ventilator and was fed through a tube. Now, think about this, ladies and gentlemen. Breathing through a ventilator and being fed through a tube. How many folks have ever had that situation in their own lives or in the life of a family member, say maybe an elderly family member, or say maybe a family member that had an accident?
I'm one of those people, Barry.
One of those people.
I have not had to be on a ventilator, but I have had to have an airway tube. Otherwise, I would have died. There's no two ways about it. I had major facial smash up, and if you see me, you'll see that the results of that.
and you actually came through that pretty well. I mean, I know you have. You can't move your arm in a certain angle.
Yeah, there's
like
things,
some other.
Yeah,
there's certain things.
I've lost teeth recently due to the long-term results of this accident 30 some years ago, and now I'm starting to lose teeth over it. Well, thanks a lot, guys. At least I fit in Lincoln County. Just kidding, folks. Just kidding.
Okay. Okay. Well, we're not going to be syndicating out to Licking County radio stations.
Yes. Well, WLRY does cover Licking County. So.
Well, okay. All right. Well, very good.
I'm just kidding, folks. I'm raised in Licking County. Give me a break.
The opinions expressed herein do not necessarily represent the opinions of the other host of the program.
No, this is a familial kidding.
Yes. Okay. Well, let's get back to this yeah. timeline. So here we are with the hospital administration going to court to basically take the child off life support and let him die. And in the 11th of April, so this went on for like 5 weeks. The justice basically said, yeah, doctors can stop providing life support treatment after he, and he's at the family division of the High Court in London. That's where he resides. And it's interesting because the paper noted, he concluded that life support treatment should end and said a move to a palliative care regime, that's an end of life, you're just basically waiting on somebody to die and you're not providing them any medical assistance.
Relieve pain. That's the
would be in Charlie's best interests. That's what gets me. This is a judge saying it's going to be in that child's best interest to let them die. When is that ever in a child's best interest? When is that ever in anybody's best interest if there is a chance? And again, the parents know that there is a definite possibility and they've raised the money to do it, to bring their baby to America to allow treatments to be done that might address the condition that he has and give him a better, higher chance of surviving longer with this condition. But no, the hospital and this judge say, we know better than the parents. And so then, at the beginning of May, a couple weeks later, the parents asked, they went to the Court of Appeals to take the case up. And about 3 weeks after that, the Court of Appeals dismissed the appeal. So they didn't want to overturn the family court judge. And so this is at the end of May. So beginning of June, they obviously appealed immediately to the Supreme Court in London, the English Supreme Court. And on the 8th of June, the Supreme Court sided with the hospital.
Well, of course they did. That's almost inevitable. Because
almost inevitable. That's
it's
right.
Because, now, Barry, it's not about what's right for the child at this point. It has stopped long ago being that. It's about control over care. And who lives and who dies. In other words, the state is desperately trying to become God.
Exactly. In other words, and this is the point we want to drive home, folks, it doesn't matter about the individual anymore. It matters about the underlying control structure. And that's what this case gets to. So they go to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court says no. Their attorneys, because the parents obviously had to get attorneys, basically made an appeal of submission to the European Court of Human Rights, because obviously this is before, they could still do that, although I know with England now going into the Brexit thing and separating from the European Union.
That's months away, though. It's a
question of whether or not the European Court of Human Rights is actually going to have any sway over British law at all. But doesn't matter, because the judges on the 20th of June, so here just last month, the judges started to analyze the case when they made their submissions, and a spokesperson for the European Court of Human Rights said that, quote, in light of the exceptional circumstances of this case, the court has already accorded it priority and will treat the application with the utmost urgency, unquote. Okay, so a week later, the 27th of June, the European Court of Human Rights issued a decision that they refuse to intervene. They don't want to get in the middle of it. And I am sure, Chuck, that it's only based on the merits of the case and not upon
oh, come on.
any countervailing idea
yeah.
that the government should have the right to decide who lives and who dies.
Pardon our cynicism, folks, at least mine.
Mine too.
This is nonsense. This is because the government has to be in control. I mean, if the way case law has been worked out to work, case law is supposed to be apply only to the litigants of the case. But the fact is, what would happen? Let's say the courts intervened in this case. Then the courts would look at it and say, we'd have to intervene in every case and actually allow people to live.
Yeah, exactly.
And get treatment.
Exactly.
And the fact is, we've set up this system where they would get quote-unquote free treatment. Remember, there's nothing free. Somebody pays for it eventually. What would this do to the system once you've got the requirement that all these children and adults who are having these issues and need these treatments rather than and become a burden on the system, if you will, quote unquote. What would happen? Well, everybody would have to be saved. What does that do to the cost? This is Barry.
There you have it. That's what it's really about.
It would essentially bankrupt governments. You'd have to go to a 75% taxation system, that kind of thing. You know, it's interesting that in the United States, when churches ran things, people got treatments. They were required to pay something, but very often those treatments were subsidized, especially for church members. If you were a Methodist and you went to Riverside Methodist Hospital, it's like being a student at a Methodist college. You get a tuition break because you are a tithing member of the church that runs the school.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing happened in hospitals. You got a break because you were a tithing member of the church that ran the hospital. Does that happen anymore? No.
Yeah, let's not get ourselves.
And we're becoming more and more and more dependent on government subsidy. And I'll be quite honest, one of the reasons for that, my wife is going through this now. Doctors are so afraid of being sued for not finding problems that are buried very, very, very deep that they send you for testing that makes absolutely no sense.
Of course not.
Or even if it does make sense, they're so bent on discovering this deeper problem that you may choose not to have treated. I mean, I've just been through situations with someone at church who basically found out that they had stage 4 ovarian cancer and took a look at what they were promising they would get from this treatment, which would have been immensely expensive and immensely invasive and immensely debilitating to the person. And she took a look at that and said, I'm 69 years old, which isn't ancient by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm 69 years old. I'm a widow. And do I really want to go through that to get between a year and 24 months, between 1 and 2 more years extra, during which at least 6 months of that I'm going to be recovering from the treatment? And she looked at it and said, no, I'll pass. I'll let God do what he will do. And that's a real important thing to think about, Barry. I once worked for a guy. He and I would have these knockdown, drag-out fights, discussions, if you will. And we had a technician that worked in our department at the time who had premature babies, like really, really, really premature. Like this is 20 years ago, and these babies were 27 or 28 weeks. So we were on the cusp of that at that time. You know, the survivability time keeps getting shorter and shorter and shorter. I think it's down to like 21 weeks you can save a preemie baby. And they're tiny, tiny, tiny little things, completely helpless, mm-hmm. completely dependent upon us. Anyway, woman had a set of twins that were born way, way, way prematurely. And he railed against this. He goes, we are spending our national treasure. Now, this is the exact words he used. We're spending our national treasure on treating these infants who are going to have a lifetime of trouble. And yeah, a lot of times preemie babies do have a lifetime of trouble with lung development and that kind of thing. But the fact is, very often they live long, full lives, living into the great old age. But the fact is that he was demanding that in order to save our national treasure, and I asked him the question, which he couldn't answer, and he kind of poo-pooed. He didn't answer it by simply dismissing it. And I said, why do you suppose God has favored us with national treasure? Is it not the protection of the little ones and the innocent? Judicially innocent. Let's put it that way. You know, we run into trouble with some of our pro-life friends who are like the yes. innocent unborn. Okay, judicially innocent, meaning they haven't committed any crime. Are they right. born? Are they born sinners? Yes, they are born sinners. So they're not born innocent in a larger sense, but they are born judicially innocent, obviously, because no baby right. has ever right. been a klepto or that kind of thing. Although
I try to be sensitive to that as well, yeah. Chuck. So I use the term defenseless unborn.
There you go.
Because that's the big issue is they can't defend themselves, and the person who's supposed to be defending them the most, their mother who has them in her womb, isn't. Or the parents who have come together and whose that you know chromosomes have brought this new life into being. Won't, or that you have an outside force that's trying to do something to injure the child, or as we quote the court in this case, and there's another quote down below that basically said that that judge ruled that Charlie should be quote allowed to die with dignity.
Whatever that means. Yeah.
Well, no, death with dignity. Those are buzzwords, Chuck. That's the euthanasia movement. That's
yes,
the assisted
exactly.
suicide movement. And that's part of what's been tied up into this thing. Now, again, this case still goes on because remember, that was basically on the 27th of June when the European Court of Human Rights said, we're not going to take this up. So the hospital basically said, well, that this was a end of a difficult process. Well, it wouldn't have been a difficult process had you guys not decided to play God. It wouldn't have been a difficult process had you said, all right, well, you found some treatments in America, you've got the money raised, you want to take your child and go, and we'll release the child to your care and back to your care, and you go and take care of finding help for your child, because we can't do it here at the hospital. No, they had to get in there and say, no, we don't think that you can do that because we've decided that it's not worthwhile. And so the child just doesn't have any value to us, and so he must die.
Yeah. Now, what about the, I'm going to go back to my nexus thing. I said this is where biblical ethics and morality meet government ethics and morality. In England, what do we know about the church in England? Who is the head of the church in England, the at least ceremonially, who's the head of the Church of England?
Well, the monarch.
Yes, the monarch.
The queen.
And
in this case.
And what does the queen, how does the queen ceremonially anyway, through whom does she run the church?
The Archbishop of Canterbury.
The Archbishop of Canterbury. He is the titular head of the Anglican Church. Let me ask you a question. Where's the Anglican Church Anglican Church or the Church of England? Where is the Anglican Church on these questions?
Missing in action?
MIA, baby. Nowhere to be found. Now, why is the Archbishop of Canterbury not jumping up and down and screaming at the top of his lungs about the ethical breach in simply withdrawing treatment from sick and helpless individuals?
My guess is probably because they just don't want to get involved.
Okay, why not?
Stay out of it.
Why not?
I don't know. I'm not sure why they wouldn't want to get involved, except for the fact that they've basically given up their mandate as a church to speak into the culture and to defend life and to protect the defenseless.
Bingo. Now let me ask you a question. Another question. What two main religions, two religious denominations is England split between?
Catholic and Anglican, right?
Yeah, yes, Catholic. Where's the Pope?
Ah, now I'm glad you said that because the Pope has weighed in. Right before our holiday, the 4th of July, on the 2nd of July, the current Pope, Pope Francis, decided to intervene a little bit in this, or at least to stick out there and make it look as if the Catholic Church is doing something. And I don't say that to offend any of my Catholic friends, but once you hear what they've said, you're going to understand what I mean by that. Basically, in this timeline, it's described that Pope Francis sent a message of support to Charlie's parents. Sounds great, right? That's wonderful. Good. And this is what the Pope said, saying that life support must not be turned off. Okay, well, bully for him, right? Stop. Until Charlie dies of natural causes. The Vatican-owned pediatric hospital in Rome said it was willing to continue Charlie's end-of-life care. See, now, it's been misreported that the Vatican said they would take the child and treat him at their hospital. No. All they're offering is palliative care,
yep.
Chuck.
Yep.
They just want to transfer the child from the Great Ormond Street Hospital in London to their hospital, but they're going to do the same thing. They're not giving the child treatment. They're not trying to address the issues that are causing him to die. They just want to make him more comfortable. That didn't get reported in the initial reporting, but I'm glad that the actual thing that they actually put out there has now been put out by the paper, because that's no different than what Ormond Street's offering.
No, that's exactly right. Palliative care until natural death.
And honestly, that is an untenable position. Now, and the reason why this is so frustrating, Chuck, the reason why, you know, you kind of get that, you know, with our president, with Trump, you know, we're kind of like America first and nationalists, and, you know, we're trying to stay out of other people's affairs to some extent. More so in some areas than in others. I get that.
Yeah.
And of course, that Trump, you know, right before the 4th of July, sent a message of support to Charlie's parents and offered to help. Well, there's a good reason why we should be offering to help. And that reason is that the hospital that has been doing the experiments is showing some success.
Yes.
Because it just came out yesterday, Chuck, that there's a neurologist who refuses to put their name out there because they don't want to get involved in the embroiled in the hubbub. Basically, the parents filed another appeal or another set of interlocutories with that family court, with the judge, Justice Francis, and the family high court. And actually, in London, and today, as we're taping this on Friday, that hearing is underway, or has been underway since, I think, London's, what, about 9 hours ahead of us, or something like that?
Seven
hours ahead of us. So, yeah, it's...
Take it back. Five hours. Yeah.
So that hearing's been going on for a few hours now since we're recording this. But basically, this neurologist filed with the court and told the court that a new analysis of a study of 9 children with a disease similar to Charlie's but not nearly as severe showed 5 of them, a 56% success rate, had improved after receiving that experimental treatment. That means there's hope, folks. That means that there's a possibility that this child could be helped by everybody in England just stopping for a moment and saying, wait a minute, this is about how we respect life and not how we control power. But of course, without some miraculous intervention, Chuck, and you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
This child's doomed because it's all about power. That's what this whole fight's been over. It's all about power, and this baby and his parents are caught in the middle of this maelstrom. This is all about the government and the government-run systems basically deciding that they have the right to determine who lives and who dies based upon their determination of the quality of that person's life. Chuck, we've been fighting that issue over here for years.
Yes.
Years and years, that it's not about quality of life. It's about the idea of life itself. And folks, we're losing the battle. I mean, you know, we've got pushes now. We had to fight last fall to get a piece into legislation to get into law to basically say that you can't help somebody commit suicide, that a doctor can't prescribe a lethal dose, or anybody else can't help the individual to basically kill themselves, which is what's starting to happen in this country as it's being celebrated by the left and by media, that, you know, that's the best idea of self-determination is taking your own life when you decide that you don't want to live any longer. There's a very short step between that and the government deciding, yeah, well, we know what's best for you better than you do, so we'll tell you when you die and how long you can live and what your quality of life is going to be and what you can and can't do with it, which is exactly what's going on here. And if you're paying any attention at all in the United States, and folks, I'm paying attention to this because I'm working with the Terry Schiavo Life and Hope Network and Bobby Schindler, Terry Schiavo's brother, and a number of other pro-life people, because we've got a mess on our hands in this country with the way our laws have been written in relation to this palliative care issue. And we're going to try to change the direction in Ohio next, as we start coming in the fall and next year. And it's going to be a fight, because we're going to be fighting the medical industrial complex, and we're going to be fighting the government that benefits benefits in the sense of gets campaign checks written to them by that medical industrial complex over this particular issue of, can we intentionally withhold food and hydration from a patient in order to hasten their death?
Yeah,
because right now in law, you can.
Wow.
You can. And if you've ever talked to people who've had loved ones in hospice care or at end of life, you're going to start hearing some similar themes over and over again about how that treatment went. But we now consider basic food and hydration a medical intervention, Chuck, by law.
Okay. I lived in Michigan in the from the mid-80s until the mid-90s.
So you ran during the time of Dr. Jack.
Dr. Jack. Let me tell you something about that guy and his attorney. First of all, his attorney was a guy named Jeffrey Feiger, and he turned out to be just an ethical nightmare.
One would not wonder.
He both ran for governor and was disbarred. He ran for governor on the strength of his defense of Dr. Kevorkian. Let me tell you something. If there was somebody that you were going to base a movement on, I would assume that a necrophile probably should not be one of the people you would want to base that movement on. And yet Kevorkian showed that he had some kind of strange obsession with death.
Yes.
He was a painter. He was a quote-unquote artist. And if you look at his paintings, he is celebrating death. Death is just this is the Brooke Shields quote: "If you die young, you've lost a very important part of your life." Death, of course, is part of life. You're going to die. But think about it this way, Barry. I'm always taken aback by the way the raising of Lazarus is portrayed in the Bible. When Jesus found out Lazarus was dead, what did he do? His friend Lazarus. Do you remember?
He went to him and yeah. he called him out of his grave.
Well, but what did he do? He wept.
He wept, yes, yes.
Bitterly, he wept. Why? This is the man who had the power over life or death. The God-man who had the power over life or death. Why did he weep? Well, there's a couple reasons he might have wept. First of all, Lazarus was his friend. He loved his friend. Jesus was present in the body, and his friend was no longer present in the body. He had passed on to the next world. So Jesus was feeling that human emotion of grief for his friend, knowing full well that he was going to raise him from the dead. Now, there may have been a sadness from Christ, knowing full well that he was dragging him back from being in the presence of God. That may have evoked sadness.
Yes, but absolutely. Think about
when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane praying, what did he pray? He prayed, "Lord, if there's any way for this cup to pass from me." Why would he pray that? Was it, you know, the torture he was about to undergo? That's part of it. Was it death? Well, Jesus was fully human and fully man. Did he want to die? No, he didn't.
No, of course not.
So we have this reverence for life, even with the person who holds the keys of the power over life and death. He didn't want to die either. And he certainly didn't want his friends to die. So why do we have this irreverence for life? Why do we allow guys like Jack Kevorkian, who had a preoccupation with death, to sway public opinion? Now, how many people actually knew that Jack Kevorkian had this weird obsession with death? Well, unless you were paying really close attention, unless you lived in Michigan at the time, and believe me, this was highly controversial. It was a big fight inside Michigan, big, as well as nationally. And again, the same person who told me we needed to stop spending our national treasure on saving premature infants also was all for Kevorkian going. He says, if I got sick, first I would call Kevorkian to bring his little death machine around. And the way Kevorkian basically, all he would do was do the IV hookup. He would do the IV hookup on this quote-unquote death machine, which was essentially this, it was a thing that held three bottles full of IV fluid that had, and once you flip the last button, this the lethal dose of whatever he was using would enter your veins. But you did it yourself. So when it was doctor-assisted suicide, some states have taken on this thing. I think states like Oregon and Washington have legalized doctor-assisted suicide. So how's that working out? But usually you go to places like the Netherlands. They have doctor-assisted suicide there.
I want to plug that, you know, if people want to get more up on what's going on across this country, you can go to a website that's the Patients' Rights Council. They're actually based here in Ohio, out of Steubenville. Rita Marker, who's an attorney, has been fighting this issue for years. And their team, they do a crack job of seeing what's happening as states are moving toward doctor-assisted suicide, et cetera. Because, you know, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, some other state, Montana, have all gone over and legalized assisted suicide, just like the Netherlands has.
Well, let's go back. Yeah.
And we're going to talk about the Netherlands in just a second. But they actually are digging and finding the data and the information and showing you what exactly is happening. And what's happening is the stuff of nightmares.
It is, yes.
People who end up being assisted to die who under what we could say is unique circumstances, etc. Not really knowing whether this is being done voluntarily or involuntarily, willingly or by somebody else's fiat. That's what's going on. But go to the Patients' Rights Council, and we'll put up their website link on our website, and you can learn more about that.
Well,
but you were going to talk about the Netherlands.
Yeah, I want to talk about the Netherlands. And when I go out to the Patients' Rights Council, what do you know? There's a headline here. Netherlands considers euthanasia for healthy people. Doctors say things are getting out of hand. Things have been out of hand in the Netherlands for years. Basically, right to die in the Netherlands has turned into duty to die. There are people who are essentially being force euthanized in the Netherlands, and it's been that has been going on for years, and it grew out of the quote unquote right to die. And right to die has become duty to die for those who basically hospitals don't want to treat. So hospitals will go to a court and say this person has no chance of recovery, and it's going to be very expensive to maintain their life through palliative care to the end of their life. We want the right to terminate. And Dutch courts are giving the right to terminate on that basis. And when I say terminate, I mean murder. Because any death that isn't a natural death, that is, God decides the timing, although the God decides the timing even on those who terminated, that is basically the state then decides when you die, not God deciding when you die. Now, is that a dangerous concept? Well, all we got to do is look at the example of the Netherlands. We now have cases where people in the United States, we've already seen this, have attempted to have relatives and children and adults, parents, grandparents, and that kind of thing, euthanized because, after all, it's eating up their fortune and they're not going to recover anyway. Whether they be comatose, whether they be have some terminal illness, some people are saying with Alzheimer's disease that they want to be able to do early terminations for that kind of thing. This is an ethical nightmare, and the church is sitting here in the United States. I'm not sure what the church is thinking about. They're wringing their hands, not sure what to do because so many of them have been infected with this radical two kingdom thing that we need to let society do what it's going to do. And the fact is that letting society do what it's going to do is how we got here in the first place. Refusing to intervene, refusing to get involved. The church is now sort of reaping the whirlwind after it sowed the wind. One thing I will say about our Catholic friends, they were first on the scene on the abortion question. Where was the Protestant church when the 1973 Roe v. Wade thing came about? They were nowhere to be found.
The Protestant church was nowhere to be found, and the Catholic church actually, was taking up the mantle.
Exactly. They're the ones that have been doing the heavy hitting from the early days. Now, does that mean the Protestant church didn't catch up? No. They've done pretty good job.
No, they caught up, yeah.
Yeah, they did a pretty good job. But the Catholics led the way. And that being said, where's the Catholic Church on this now? Well, you've got the Vatican basically coming out and saying, we're okay with palliative care rather than treatment. Okay, look, there are some people that who aren't gonna recover. And would heavy duty treatment, should you be able to force heavy duty treatment on somebody? Well, again, my friend who just died of ovarian cancer would not have been happy with being forced to take the treatments that she refused. Now,
exactly, but she had the informed consent right to do that.
Bingo. That's a different thing.
And now we get back to that whole in loco parentis thing, because there are parents here with Charlie Gard who are trying to make the best decisions they can for their child in order to preserve his life and to possibly get him on the road to having a healthier life, and they're being denied that because someone else is acting in loco parentis and taking away their rights as a parent.
Exactly. It is about basically choosing whether or not to take a treatment that can either save your life or not. In this case, this treatment will prolong the child's life, perhaps up to the point of puberty, Will the child ever be normal? Well, unless some miraculous treatment is developed sometime between now and when the child dies, the answer is no. But is quote-unquote normal life, in other words, average intelligence, average health, that kind of thing, necessarily something that has to happen before you have the right to life? The right to life is not dependent upon your physical or mental condition. And somehow the idea that because someone is retarded, they should be put away in terms of death, that is a grotesque idea. That is an idea that comforts those of us who don't want to have to deal with it, who don't want to have to be involved in the care and treatment of individuals like this. This is why, you know, there's a show on A&E, and it's called Born This Way.
Okay.
And it's about people who are Down syndrome. And, you know, what kind of life they're going through and what their parents are going through, you know, what they want to do. It sort of explodes a lot of myths. It's basically there's a lot of these people who are very high functioning. You know, they're in the average intelligence area. They have the physical issues that Down syndrome people very often have. They're small in stature. They have the facial shapes. You know, when I was a kid, you called Down syndrome people Mongoloids because they had the facial features of Mongols. I mean, that was essentially it. What's interesting is to watch the worry of the parents who worry about their children as they go forward. Now, Down syndrome people live a lot longer than they used to, but they're highly susceptible to all kinds of strange diseases like leukemia and that kind of thing. I don't understand exactly why. And for some reason, God has decided that some of these people need to be this way. Should these people be just simply brushed under the carpet and allowed to be aborted because they're going to have Down syndrome or some other odd genetic disease? And the answer is no. But the fact is that very few Down syndrome children are born now because doctors are encouraging people to have genetic testing and are saying things like, you know, that child's never going to live a normal life. What is a normal life? You know, Down syndrome people can love Jesus just as much as people with their full genetic complement intact.
Chromosomes, that's
yeah,
right.
That's right.
Absolutely.
And the idea that somehow, well, this is going to be a burden on me, therefore I need to abort, and that's what's happening to a lot of Down syndrome and other genetic issues. And thank God these parents didn't do that. You know, they may have been able to find this out, that this would have happened. I don't understand everything I know about mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome, whether it's a gene expression problem or a genetic issue, a problem with the actual genetic makeup. I have a feeling it's a gene expression issue. And if it is a gene expression issue, then something can be found eventually, I'm confident, to treat it. Now, that being said, these parents have the right to have their child survive as long as possible, so with the hope that that treatment can be found, I think. And also, to enjoy their child and have their child enjoy his life to the fullest extent that God has laid out. That's the bottom line. And right now, we have a lot of people who don't understand, who've rejected God and his power over life and death. And that's a sad place to be. Well, Barry, guess what? We're out of time.
I figured we might be, Chuck. And, you know, I just want to make sure that people are aware we're going to keep paying attention to this issue. And we need to talk more about these issues, and you should talk with your family members about your healthcare choices and look at your documents and talk with your medical, your family doctor, whoever it is, to make informed decisions. And again, we're going to put up the parent, Patients' Rights Council information up on our website. And folks, we just encourage you to go there. And they've got a nice little card that you can take with you to your doctor of questions you need to ask.
Okay, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.